Welcome to Black in Data Talks. I'm Sadiqa Musa. I'm joined today by Davina and Michelle from The Guardian. Michelle talks to us about what ChatGPT is and how it is used in our day-to-day lives. We discuss the technology behind ChatGPT, its limitations and dangers. Finally, we discuss how it is being used at The Guardian. Let's talk.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Black in Data Talks. We're going to be talking today about ChatGPT, a hot topic. I'm joined by Sadiqa Musa, who is the founder of Black in Data. And then we've also got a special guest today from The Guardian. His name is Michelle Shammell. Michelle, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself before we move on to the hot topic and Guardian?
Yeah, absolutely. My background is actually, I'm a physicist by training. I was an astrophysicist before, and I looked kind of at big objects in the sky and did a lot of data analysis. So it was quite natural for me to go into the area that I'm working now in. So I'm a data scientist now, a senior data scientist at The Guardian. It came quite natural that I wanted to. In physics, you tend to, when you do data analysis, you tend to learn a lot about statistics, but also do quite a bit of programming, quite a bit of data wrangling very often. And these are quite kind of all the skills that a data scientist usually has and definitely needs. I left academia though, and then joined the BBC as in their research and development department. So I became sort of like a commercial researcher, research engineer, I call it. They called it a technologist, but there I worked on quite interesting topics, from like binaural audio, which is a lot of audio signal processing, to kind of more machine learning topics such as automatic football player recognition and pose recognition. So that means that if you have a still of people on the pitch, can a computer automatically guess where the players are and in what kind of position, what kind of pose they are. Then other things I've worked on is a project called reflective profiling. So that was about kind of automatically generating metadata of audio, video, and also text in order to understand more what the content is about, kind of in view in the direction of microgenres, and to be able to expose this kind of more knowledge to the user. So we could tell the user what your preference is to have, you know, episodes X long about a very specific topic, not only about politics, but maybe a very specific bit of politics, maybe Canadian politics from the 1960s, something like that. So that was a really interesting project. It was a research project, so it never saw the production phase, but it was nevertheless super interesting to see people interact with it in a test phase. I moved into BBC News, where I worked on multi-language recommenders. So I've trained recommenders that were content, so article to article. So I'm reading this article about a specific topic. Can you suggest more articles of a similar or the same topic? What was really fascinating was, because this was for the World Service, this was for five different languages, I think Turkish, Hindi, Spanish, Portuguese, Arabic, and Russian. So maybe six languages, sorry. And what was really interesting was, because I understand Spanish, but obviously I don't understand Russian, Turkish. So it was really kind of how to approach this project when you are not necessarily as a data scientist have this language background, and also find a way of creating and training these models sort of almost agnostic to language. I mean, we train specific models for each language, but nevertheless, we needed to find a way of training these models without having a very different, you know, specific vocabulary or method for one language and not for the others. The beauty of BBC World Service is that there are so many native speakers around. So we did kind of interact a lot with journalists who were native speakers in those languages to test and benchmark and evaluate these models and make sure that they deliver sound recommendations. And then I moved to an innovation unit within an insurance company, which is quite a different turf. A really big insurance in the UK. It was super interesting to see a very different world. And I worked mainly on kind of also recommenders, multi-armed bandits, things like that, before I moved to The Guardian. So I moved to The Guardian 3.5 years ago, I think. Yeah, just in the first lockdown. Start long ago. I'm a senior data scientist there. I work on mostly on natural language processing, so the field of computer understand the semantics and the syntactics of language, and worked on very different projects from like automatic quote extraction, so I can only spot a text whether the text is a quote and who can it be attributed to, up to things like live block filters, so where we're trying to give the reader and the user a better or an easier way to navigate these long blocks that you get from the daily roundups, which consists of individual posts, by surfacing like common entities, you know, if it's about politics, politicians' names and stuff, and can you filter these live blocks just by clicking on these filters, and then get like follow a specific topic rather than the whole live block if you prefer. Lastly, I'm now sitting in an internal group that looks at ChatGPT, more general generative AI, the opportunities within The Guardian and what we could potentially do with it, what The Guardian could benefit from these technologies.
That's a very, very interesting career that you've had, Michelle. There. It's just I'm just so engrossed in listening to the journey. I mean, did you say insurance? That's a bit different. Probably. How did you find that experience compared to all of the things that you've done so far?
It was very interesting because it's a heavily regulated, right? It's financial institutions, so they're heavily regulated. So they are very risk averse and need to do everything proper and square everything off. So it was a very different field to maneuver. But however, there was a huge appetite in innovation and and you know, from kind of chatbots to recommenders, they were really trying to find the space where machine learning to the benefit of the customers, but also to the company. And because it was such a big insurer, it was fantastic. It was so many opportunities.
Awesome. Well, so before our discussion on ChatGPT, I'd like to put a quick disclaimer there that all of the opinions that we're going to be discussing here are entirely yours and not that of The Guardian. So what exactly is ChatGPT, right? And how is it used in our day-to-day lives? In the simplest explanation, Michelle, like how can my little toddlers understand it if you had to break it down to them?
Okay, I start with a bit of jargon and then I'll simplify it. So
perfect.
Just to say ChatGPT stands for Chat Generative Pre-trained Transformers, and it's a form of generative AI. And what generative AI is essentially is that generative AI denotes a group of machine learning or AI models that can generate an output like, you know, an image of a paragraph, some text, even some music based on a text input that you give it, which is called a prompt. Kind of what is new with this is really very much the interfacing with these models. Whereas before you might have had to write some complicated code or, you know, send some numbers through to these models to do anything. Here it's about interfacing with them in plain English. So you literally tell them an instruction and they comply with that instruction. And the other part is the what if means that it generates stuff. So it actually, based on the prompt, or even you could give it a single word and it tries to complete this, right? It tries to come up with a response that is purely generated and not just like looked up and copy and pasted from somewhere.
That's awesome. And how is it used in our day-to-day lives?
So it depends on the person you ask, I think. I mean, it can be used anywhere. So what I find really interesting is the different kind of places where people look at it and can benefit from it, starting from, you know, students to use it either to even write their essays, but very often to do some research on them. It can help you write emails in a different way, where, you know, it can make sure that the email is as eloquent as possible. It can help you with your CVs. You can give it a lot of text and ask that, well, can you summarize this, or can you take out, you know, the key takeaways from this article, these kind of things. So it's a very useful and resourceful text-based assistant, basically. I've seen people write job adverts with them, and it's surprisingly good, actually, how well it can do with the job adverts. And yeah, just in general, blue sky thinking is fantastic. You know, it's almost like if you want to bounce off an idea of a colleague or a friend, or you can also, in addition, go to ChatGPT, and it gives you kind of a very broader perspective on things, which I think is very good as a first.
What's the best use case that you have seen so far?
Maybe we'll talk about that a tiny bit later, because the use case that I'm really like at the moment is a step further, and maybe we'll talk about that a bit, because I think that is where the future goes. So that kind of ties in with these kind of things. Yeah.
Intriguing. Can't wait.
For me, I feel like ChatGPT knows everything, but I know that there's definitely some limitations. How does it know everything, and what does it do well?
Yeah, so it knows everything up to a certain point, right? So the way these models are trained is by using huge corpora, so huge piles of text that you give it to them. Obviously, up to the point where you're starting to train, everything is up to date. But if you use text, right? So ChatGPT, the first version, I believe, was trained, text was used for up to 2021. So anything beyond 2021, it wouldn't really know about. So, for example, the first version didn't know that, you know, we now have a king and not a queen. Basically, because it has all this knowledge and has all this text, which mainly comes from the internet, that is really the background knowledge. So it effectively, the amount of text it has been trained with is, I think it takes thousands of human lifetimes to read the equivalent. So it's a large amount, you know, tens of gigabytes, if not hundreds of gigabytes of data. So yeah, that's what makes it kind of all knowing, because it has such a big breadth of knowledge and information that is put into it.
One other thing I wanted to ask was, so if I was to ask it to tell me about astrophysics, just because you mentioned it earlier, like how does it do that? Like, how does it pretty much instantly what astrophysics is?
Yeah, so this is part of the way it was trained. So maybe to go a bit into detail, what ChatGPT consists of. It consists of mainly three parts, and maybe let's start with the first part, because that's I think the one that is responsible for finding, you know, for answering what astrophysics is about. The first part of ChatGPT is a large language model called an LLM. And the way that this is trained, this is kind of where the knowledge sits. So it's fed these huge amounts of text, but it's using a method called text mask token. So it's basically being fed text where part of it is removed, and it needs to guess or predict what the parts that the words that were removed, what those words were. And it's trained like that. So meaning that it will learn over a long time and over many, what you call epochs, many iterations, to predict these words correctly. And what happens, which is really interesting, this is something that similar, more primitive models showed as well. Google came up with the first word-to-vec model, which is used a similar approach. And what you find is these models, as they learn to predict these words very well, they also start to understand some of the semantics behind these words. So going back to your question about astrophysics, so basically what it does is it's trying to complete the sentence. If you type in astrophysics is, it will find the most likely words, the best words possible to complete the sentence. So because it has learned all of this knowledge about, so in astrophysics, there's almost certainly, you know, the words that come up when you talk about astrophysics are galaxies, sky, telescope, things like that. So, you know, physics, study, research. So it will start creating a sentence that has almost all these words in, and therefore will tell you, will tell you kind of in a broader way what astrophysics is about. Another important aspect of ChatGPT is that it, so OpenAI experimented before ChatGPT with something called InstructGPT, where it gave a kind of the large language model that underneath some instructions, it trained it to answer these instructions. And kind of where the step goes from just, you know, I give you a word and you could complete it with likely words that come with it, to I actually, the model takes some instructions in and actually responds to those specific instructions. And so this second part actually makes it then, rather than just kind of filling out the words and making it some kind of, you know, nice looking sentence, but not really responding to your query, you move from that stage to actually giving it an instruction and getting back the a coherent paragraph based on the instructions you give it, based on the request you gave it. This is part of the second part. The other part of the second part is what you call a reward model via human feedback. So what happened is so if you have some generative AI, it's you need to assess when you train, you need to assess what's good and what is not good, right? When you have like a classical data science problem, you know, predict house prices or predict, I don't know, marketing efficiencies, things like that, you usually have a specific number that you know, and you want to predict that number. So you have a data set that is inputs and also the target. So where I want to go, where I need to be. And then it's very easy to define, right, what is good, what is not good, and what is the error between your prediction and the actual world, because you can calculate the difference between them or calculate some kind of metric between them. With generative AI, because it generates each time when you're given an instruction, generates a new paragraph, it's not very easy to straight away think of a metric because you know, you basically would need a human for every response, and they need to assess, and then also you need to think about like how do you average that out between humans. Are different raters, are different annotators, do they have different opinions, etc. So what OpenAI did was basically they trained a reward model. So they trained a model based on feedback from humans. So what happened is you give instructions to the large model, you get back the generated text, and you let humans rank these texts. So for a specific query, you get multiple texts, so you run it multiple times, and humans rank these outputs from good to bad, and you use that data to train a reward model. So this model, all it does is it sees the prompt, so the instruction, it sees the generated text and decides, is this good or bad? And this is kind of the way of circumventing this problem, or actually solving this problem of not knowing kind of how to attribute that metric. So it's a ranking system, and that predicts, or second model, this reward model, predicts how good this response is. And then comes the third part. And the third part is really interesting, because effectively what you use is you take your initial model, the one that generates text, you take a copy of it. So you fine-tune that model, which means you continue training that model with a set of instructions that go in and then the generative text that comes out. And use your reward model to basically score those. So the reward model gives you the feedback to the model you're trying to fine tune to improve on the answers. So in other words, you have a system where you have a model that generates text and a kind of score or model that feeds back, and this loop, this reinforcement loop we call it, encourages the model to find better and better answers in order to satisfy this reward function. So hence, once you're done training, this model has ideally the best answers possible that you can train on. But there's another interesting fact in this third one, is that not only do you fine-tune the model and that, but you also calculate how much does this new model deviate from your old model, and you put that into the scoring as well. And the reason why that is if you're in a system where, you know, you have basically it's an adversarial game almost, right? You have one model that is trying to please this reward model as much as possible, reward model giving it scores, this fine-tuned model could relatively easily, or at least over the time, figure out whether how to kind of game the reward model and just find the best possible answer, and therefore always satisfying the reward model, and yet not really or only tangentially responding to your input, right, to your instruction. So the idea here is that if you keep the original model also in the loop and calculate the difference between the response what the original model gives you and the fine-tuned model gives you, it kind of puts it a bit on rails. It kind of makes sure that the new fine-tuned response is not something wacky that just goes all overboard. So it's really about trying to keep the fine-tuned model kind of at bay. Yeah, it's sort of put a leash on it or something, if you want to go with that metaphor.
That was very insightful, Michelle, because before this, it was very complicated when you go into the back end and trying to understand its complexities. But the way you've just sort of brought down the 1, 2, 3 steps is quite easy to follow. So thank you on that. So earlier on, you touched briefly on the limitations, right? So maybe if we can deep dive into that slightly, let's understand what the limitations are, some and the potential harms that we can get from the usage of ChatGPT.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's important to say that this is a bit of a moving target, because the way ChatGPT is set up, you know, there's millions of people who use it already. So they get quite a lot of data by people interacting with it. Some of these, or the initial issues that we found, they actually kind of have partially or in full already remedied. But there are still some kind of fundamental issues that are embedded in the way it was trained and also the way it's set up. So maybe if we go back to the first part of this model, right? So it's very trained to predict the next word or masked words. So therefore it's really good at kind of feigning inherent knowledge of a topic, but it's not necessarily has this knowledge. So for example, what we found really interesting was that the most obvious one that everybody talks about, right, the factual accuracy. It makes stuff up, it doesn't really it tells you something completely correct, and then the next sentence it comes up with something completely that's completely wrong. I mean, we tried a lot around the royal family. And it's really interesting how it came up with something like, Prince Charles is his own dad and married to the Queen, things like that, right? I mean, this was early days, so I imagine they have remedied some of that, but yeah. Factual accuracy is a big flaw, and that's why it's important, if you use it for research, to not really fully trust it, but verify all your all these statements and sources. I think it's very good in kind of highlighting on a high level, the controversies or the questions relating to a topic, but it's really should only be used in order to kind of use that as a starting point, and then do your own research or follow these leads and see whether they're actually true or not. Other things it's not very good at, we were really surprised it can't count. So we looked at a public data set and just asked how many occurrences of this person or this organization is in this data set. And it came back with a number, and we were like, okay, cool, that seems to have worked. And then we just did like a crude text search on it. numbers deferred, and the number on the text search was much higher. So it definitely failed to count. Either it missed something. I don't think it's equipped to do things like that. So at the moment, at least. And then also in general, like we asked it sort of mathematical reasoning, spatial reasoning, reasoning in physics, things like which it didn't get right. You know, sort of spatial reasoning was interesting. We said like, you know, four people sit in this sequence, in this order next to each other. If you swap person two and three, who is now next to person three? And it got it completely wrong, things like that. Mm-hmm. Other interesting things was, so a colleague of mine looked at musical transposition, something I'm not well versed at, but apparently there it also tried to pick up some funky scales or some funky transpositions that didn't work at all. And then a lot of, in general, logic-related tasks, it's not as good. Maybe it's just interesting to note that the research field has really spotted this deficiency, and has come up with ideas and plans of attack to remedy some of that. So some of that is like people now ask the ChatGPT or any of these generative AI models to kind of elaborate on their response, so to really explain their response. And this is a process called chain of thought. So it's just like, you know, if you count this, tell me how you counted it, or tell me, you know, exactly your inner workings. So it's a bit, you know, almost like back to school in your math test, right? Don't just write the answer, just show me your workings. Mm-hmm. And it actually seems to be, when it does explicitly give out these workings, it does seem to do a much better job. It does seem to kind of either rectify itself, or even it might be aware that it is about to commit a mistake, and therefore it actually remedies that. So that's quite interesting, quite interesting development in the last couple of months.
And some of the harms that we've got here, would you like to sort of elaborate on those? Because I think we're missing a little bit from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So harms there are unfortunately many. Like it's always how much does the human want to misuse or this technology? But I mean, one especially in view of working for a media company, so content farms, I think, are a big potential harm. So these are websites or kind of fake media agencies which use ChatGPT just to generate content, but content that's not necessarily true. It's just, you know, the aim here is to put out so much content and so much misinformation that that whoever tries to disentangle, at the end of the day, that's us, right? When we read an article, we make our own assessment, but there's so much information out there that we get overwhelmed and we can no longer verify this information. So that is a real danger. I think they are certainly OpenAI, given that they you need to register for the API, and they're trying to stem some of that misuse, obviously, and prevent some of that misuse. But it feels like it could be very difficult to do that, especially in view with there are some large language models out there that are already open source, so anybody can run them on their own machines. So that's, yeah, it seems like a potential danger and harm, absolutely. As with any machine learning model, I mean, you both know this, a bias is a potential issue, and almost certainly is an issue, right? This the basis corpus that they were trained on is the internet, which is not in general a very nice place. So there's almost certainly some of these nasty texts and nasty comments and whatever coded in. I mean, these research companies do take care on and kind of sanitize the input text a bit. So they are trying to exclude very obvious problems, but there's all these kind of, you know, coverted language that would insinuate a certain bias that, you know, you can't necessarily filter out without a lot of work, or even like in the scale of this, you might not be able to filter them out at all at the moment. So one needs to be aware of these biases. What else? There's another big question regarding intellectual property and copyright. So because these models were trained on a lot of data that is kind of publicly available, but some is behind paywalls, some content publishers rely on this to make money, to survive. The question is to what extent there was consent given for these companies to take all of that text, all of that, and in order to train a model. And then on the other side, if you have a model that generates images of paintings, if it comes up with that looks very similar to Picasso because it has been trained on images of Picasso, where's the implication there? Is that an infringement of copyright? So there's a lot of questions there that are still not solved. It's really interesting. There was a federal case in the US that decided that anything generated by generative AI is not copyrighted. So at least in the US, it seems like there needs to be a human component to create something in order to have a copyright. I don't know how the situation is in the UK, what the law is here. But yeah, there's certainly still a lot to be found out, and obviously looking back at things like social media, which was reusing a lot of content with certainly not giving back to the content creators in terms of money, there are a lot of questions here that still need to be answered.
Going back to that case that you mentioned, the federal case in the US, mm-hmm. does that mean that if somebody generates some form of artwork using AI and it looks like a Picasso painting, Picasso, obviously his family, can't sue them for it?
So this is the, whatever is created by generative AI can't be subject to copyright. So it's the output, right, it's okay. Not the input.
So I can't get a painting made for me and say, hey, this was done by Davina Nembhard.
Yeah, exactly. And then you have the copyright forever. Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. And it's such a shame about the limitations, because honestly, I would love to just let ChatGPT do my job on the sly and be like, hey, I'm doing such an amazing job now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think the fundamental limitation is this kind of predicting the words, right? I think my mind was blown when I first saw that with Word2Vec, so the kind of the first algorithm that was able to fold in semantics. By learning from a corpus with masked tokens or masked words. I think we're kind of still missing a bit the trick there. So there must be another way of training or finding and conveying more the semantics of text. I don't think that has been solved yet, but I'm sure people have some ideas and will try different methods. But I think that will eventually push us further and closer to what actually might be an artificial intelligence. So I don't perceive these models yet as artificial intelligence. I still mainly use the word machine learning, although it's less fashionable. But I think we're edging towards artificial intelligence, but I think we're not quite there yet.
Okay. So Michelle works at The Guardian, so do I. How do we use, or how can we use ChatGPT at work?
Right. That's a very good question. So I think, first of all, I should say that the Guardian has published a broad position paper on how to use Gen AI and what or how potentially to use it. And it kind of really relies on a couple of kind of principles. One being like that is for the benefit of the reader. This human oversight for everything we kind of that the reader sees, we publish to the reader. That there's also a very strong point about transparency. So if we are using this in future, we will be open about it and where it's being used and where it isn't being used. The other big pillar is to improve the work of staff. So really use Gen AI not to replace humans, but rather to help them and let them do their job more efficiently. And then I think the fourth big point is again with this copyright issues, to really make sure that we respect the content creation and who owns it and who makes it. So I think we have looked at a couple of opportunities. None of this has been like actually used or in production or anything. At the moment, we're kind of more understanding the opportunities and the potential benefits. And maybe if I start with kind of the wider business. So also just to say that, you know, that some of the big tech giants are already putting these models into their kind of office suites or, you know, operating systems and stuff. So to a certain extent, a lot of companies don't really have that much choice on that side, whether they will, you know, use Gen AI or not, because it will just be there, right? And their staff can just use it. So that's that's also a question for people. But I think what's really interesting of as a publisher is like we can certainly do a lot relating to kind of our, you know, marketing messaging, like, you know, personalizing the experience for our users. I read this really interesting study about A/B testing headlines for SEO using an LLM and really kind of using the large language model to help predicting which headlines will fare better, things like that. I think there's a huge opportunity around summarization, both for kind of people who work, work on many documents together, need them compiled together, or need to be caught up. You know, they've been on holiday, coming back, need to be caught up. What has happened on this project? These kind of things. But also, likewise, potentially for readers, right? So going back to life blogs, they're quite long. They usually span multiple pages, and you know, if you join them at 4 p.m. it's been going on since 6 a.m. maybe what you really want first is a little summary of where we're at with this, you know, with this live blog or with this particular story, things like that. But also in general, I think summarization is a huge opportunity. Absolutely. Other things that it's very useful at, although that's not ChatGPT itself, that's again more using the large language model underneath it, helping with much better search. So the way you actually can semantically search for articles or anything you need, like with the same way with information retrieval. So anything you can think of. The classical example, an issue with search is you don't know the verbatim like text what you've seen something in a presentation somewhere that was roughly phrased like that, but you can't remember the exact phrasing. So if you just do like a raw text search, right, the rough phrasing will not get you there because it's not exactly how it was phrased in the presentation. If you use kind of semantic search, you're using the power of the large language models, it will find documents that are very similar to this search string, to this search sentence that you've given it, to this rough, and will actually find the right documents. So in that perspective, and that's applicable throughout the business, right? That's both on the reader side, do they want to find an article, a recipe, something like that, travel recommendation, but also on the staff side, to quickly find something that was talked about 6 months ago, or, you know, catch up with the latest progress in a certain area. So it's just, more optimized information retrieval. There's a couple of examples which are kind of more specific to the field you and I work in, Davina, like in kind of analytics and also data science. So it can definitely, what I've seen before is it can definitely create a very crude exploratory data analysis of a data set, mainly kind of creating graphs, right, with the different classes, or really understanding the data a bit better. And I think there it's very useful because that's quite a mundane and repetitive task for analysts, but also for data scientists. And I think having something there that could go get you already like 50% there, and, you know, just show you an overview of what does this data look like, what does it comprise, you know, how many values is it missing, is it skewed, things like that, would be very beneficial for our work. After all, we are we are looking at the deeper insights, and we're trying to understand the deeper knowledge within the data, rather than just trying to understand, you know, how many NAMs are there and how many numbers are missing. So in that sense, I think it could give us kind of a leg up, which would be really useful. The other one that I find quite interesting, which we haven't explored yet, but we want to, in a lot of data science problems, you very often have a data set that is not annotated or hasn't got any labels or anything, right? So ChatGPT is actually really good in when you ask it, give me one label of this article, or what is this article about? Give me that in two words or something. So it, actually, I think it'd be very useful in annotation tasks. So somewhere where you actually wanted to help to annotate a data set that you then later on train your own machine learning model on and run it in a different capacity. So I think that's an exciting area that we want to explore a bit more.
I mean, I was sold when you said it can do the mundane tasks like creating graphs. So I'll be trying that next tomorrow.
Okay, Michelle, as we're wrapping up, I've got one final question for you. What do you think the future of Gen AI looks like? It's a heavy one, but yeah. Go for it.
Okay. Yeah, definitely a heavy one. I'll talk about what I think is the most exciting bit now in Gen AI to me. And I think that's certainly the short to medium term future will go that way. So, as we already talked about, like the Gen AI is not very good at like its inherent knowledge, right? It makes things wrong, it makes stuff up. But what it's really good at is its kind of language abilities, language skills. So I think what Gen AI will become is this super sophisticated language tool that you can use as your, you know, as your little pocket calculator between inverted commas to help you as a personal assistant, but just in general to get through your life much, much quicker, right? So to understand, to get your summarizations, if you have a lot of emails, just give me a summary of these, or tell me which of these millions of emails I just got are the most important ones, things like that. But this kind of summarization and personalization tool, I mean, it has both benefits and possible harms, right? In thinking of back of battles, etc. But I think that you can use this tool in no matter which regard, as long as you have some text, you can, you know, weed out almost, you know, the information overflow that you get these days, right? You get tweets or X tweets, as there's now so many messages, Instagram, WhatsApp, Telegram, whatever. Can you find, you know, can you have like an assistant that really can flag up what is important, isn't, or just give you a rundown? You know, I don't know about you both, but I'm in some WhatsApp groups where there's like 400 messages a day. I'm never ever going to read those, so might as well have a TLDR using one of these tools, which would be amazing. Yeah, and then the other thing that's also really interesting, and this is an emerging trend which a lot of startups catching up on, this is very similar to what I just said, but basically they're using a large language model or some generative AI to help you as an assistant to fetch information. For example, in search you could say, you know, when did the BBC first talk about, you know, climate change or the climate crisis, and using that as an input rather than you kind of trying to search for that. What the large language model does is it to BBC finds the earliest article mentioning this and kind of gives you a summary of that or finds that or responds to that specific question. So again, it's a kind of almost like a language Swiss Army knife that you can use for very many applications. So in that sense, I think what's more exciting, rather than just a straight, let's probe its knowledge, is what it actually can do with information you give it and with a task you give it to the task specific to that information you gave it to be solved. I think that's quite interesting.
Awesome. Well, that's all that we've got time for today, Michelle. And thank you very, very much for joining us. I mean, I am just blown away. I'm going to have to sit down and digest and re-listen to all of that all over again to get the insight to remain in my head.
Thank you so much, Davina.
Yeah, I was just going to say thank you for joining us. I feel like your talks about ChatGPT are always enlightening. Just to give you guys some context, I didn't know anything about GPT before Michelle sat down in our in a meeting at work and told us. And now he's here talking to you guys because I was just blown away about how I can use it and how simply he explained everything. Mm-hmm. And that was a part of my day-to-day life.
Yeah, now you're an expert. No?
I'm an expert, and based on what you said, Michelle, I'm expecting the next iPhone to have it built in. It can summarize all of my messages and 8,000 unread emails and let me know what I need to respond to today, tomorrow, next week.
Yeah, awesome. Great, great. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to find out more about us, please visit our website, which is www.blackindata.co.uk. You can email us at hello@blackindata.co.uk if you wish to take part in a podcast, or if you have ideas or topics you'd like us to discuss. You can even email us just to say hi. You can help us grow our community by joining us on LinkedIn. Just search Black in Data. Our Twitter and Instagram handle is blackin_data. Let's keep talking.